Welcome to the Richie Flow Nutrition Podcast. My name is Cameron Borg. On this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Alistair Nunn. Alistair is a British theoretician with a background in biochemistry, drug development, and quantum biology. He is currently the Director of Science at the Guy Foundation, where he contributes to work on bioenergetics, the thermodynamics of life, and quantum effects in biological systems. His research interests focus on understanding inflammation and aging, the implications of which are fundamental to life. This has inevitably brought his focus towards the notion of hormesis and life as a complex dissipative structure. His conception of what is important when it comes to understanding health and disease are vital, as he focuses on the most foundational aspects of life and how it is shaped. I have been looking forward to speaking to Alistair ever since I discovered his work a few years ago. His ideas and perspectives are sorely needed in today's scientific space, and I'm really grateful he gave me so much of his time to discuss these ideas. Before we start, please consider subscribing to my Substack, where I share deep dives into topics like this that go even beyond the scope of what we spoke about here. It's the best way to support me and the podcast while also getting more in-depth thoughts about these podcast topics. I've left the link in the episode notes if you're interested in supporting me that way. With all this being said, I really hope you enjoy the episode. All right, Alistair, thank you so much for giving me some of your time. I've really been looking forward to speaking with you. I've been following your work with the Guy Foundation for quite a while now, and it's really fascinated me. So, thank you so much for coming on.
Okay, well, thank you for inviting me.
I guess I wanted to start with how you sort of got mixed up with thinking so broadly in so many different fields. Starting with cannabinoids and how they work in the body. I think it's quite fascinating to hear you speak about so many different things and sort of tie them back into biology. When was the first time you sort of started to realize that so many different things, you could take so many different approaches to thinking about biology?
Well, I think, I did a degree in biochemistry, and I did a PhD looking into what porphyry is actually, which is a kind of inborn metabolism problem. I then studied apoptosis. Now, this is this program Cell Death, and I was very lucky to work with one of the leaders, a chap called Andrew Wiley. But it made me realize at the time there was a great deal more going on than I was ever taught in the halls of a university. But to be frank, I stayed with science until about 1996. And one of the reasons I left was that it was becoming increasingly difficult to find a scientific career, but importantly, make money. Now, I know this is important, and because it tells you how sometimes you have to go through various transitions. And because I've actually got some quite expensive hobbies, I fly planes quite a lot and gliders and things, and they cost money. And science at that level does not really pay. There's a whole other story as to why scientists don't generally get paid terribly well.
Yeah.
So I left and went into industry. And so I worked with a pharmaceutical company called Novartis. And again, it was a real eye-opener because I suddenly saw the other side to how things work. You know, this was the commercial organization of how you use science to effectively make money and come up with a product that you can sell, and to put it simply like that. And it's very interesting because it's obviously a lot of how the world actually works in terms of making money. But I found it difficult, and I decided after 2.5 years, because there seemed to be some kind of glass ceiling for an academic anyway, and I realized I'm still pretty academic. I like the science. I wasn't really interested in doing the marketing or anything, which is a big limiting factor in a pharmaceutical company.
Definitely.
So I was involved in clinical safety, which again really opened my eyes. So I saw a lot of the other side, which you don't always see. And I decided to leave. And I ended up thinking, well, where can I go now? And it was I was still quite young, and I thought, well, need money. I want to do something which is a bit more sciencey and a bit more interesting. And I spoke to a headhunter and I said, look, I don't mind working hard. I love science, but I kind of need a bit of money. And he went, just the place. And so he got me a job in medical communications. Now, medical communications is a parallel industry to the pharmaceutical industry. It's about marketing. They basically take on the marketing of the drugs. They're obviously a spin out from the pharmaceutical company. And effectively, they take a drug all around from phase 1, phase 2 up to marketing and organize the conferences, the publications planning and everything to make people aware that the drug is on its way. And they get you, and people like, certainly PhDs, they welcome them because, of course, you can write a bit and you can understand the science. But it's very marketing driven still. But it was more interesting because I ended up working on many different drugs. And this is the beginnings of the question you're asking is, I suddenly realized, well, actually, gosh, there's a lot more here. And you know, you can work on anything from a drug to lower cholesterol to an anti-cancer drug to something to try and treat Alzheimer's or even HIV. And suddenly you're realizing you're opening up into a whole new world of different disciplines, and certainly within biology. But one of the things that really struck me, and I wasn't the only one that got struck by this, was it was so siloed. You know, people who, doctors and medics who are involved in, say, cholesterol metabolism, don't really talk to doctors, or this certainly was the case, who do diabetes. You know, and you're thinking, oh, hang on, you know, what's going on here? And they were very message driven. And one of the things that happened when I was working in this industry is being a scientist, I started to think a bit harder about how many of these drugs must be working. As it turned out, it was not as straightforward as you think. Now, there'd be marketers saying, well, it lowers cholesterol or it lowers glucose. But I said, well, how and why? Because a lot of the drugs were originally based from plant compounds, effectively. And one of the first revelations I had, and I, during this time, I got in contact with one of my old colleagues from the university who I used to work with and who was still in the university system. And we started discussing this, and it became very apparent that a lot of drugs, for some reason, were anti-inflammatory. And this includes things like statins and things like that. And I was thinking, so what's going on here? It was quite common knowledge amongst many doctors. And they said, well, yeah, these things don't just work in the way we think they work. They're doing other things too. And I think, well, yeah, why is this? And one of the things I had worked on when I was doing my first postdoc was apoptosis, which, of course, it was very mitochondrially central. So I was quite interested in mitochondria. And suddenly we realized, of course, there was a big crossover. When you looked at many of these drugs, they were doing something similar to what exercise does in some of the benefit. Now, they didn't do it actually anything like as well as exercise. And the chap I was working with, who's Professor Jimmy Bell, he's now up in Westminster University, but he studied, his main interest was in fat distribution. And he realized very quickly, as many people did, that actually the big problem was our lifestyle. And, you know, we were eating too much, not exercising. And one of the things that came out of all of this was that, of course, this linked into mitochondrial function. And I think many people probably know about mitochondria and these little things in your cells. There's a big history on those too, but I'm not going to go into the history of those. But the point about it is they become dysfunctional. And we began to realize there's obviously a big connection here between the inflammation, mitochondrial dysfunction. And we're not the only people to think this. And suddenly a bigger picture started to emerge that, well, why is it many of these compounds do seem to alter or affect inflammation? And of course, we started to look into the literature and realized that although there wasn't much on it, a lot of these drugs also in some shape or form modulate mitochondrial function too. So suddenly you're going, a drug which was promoted as being, well, it only binds to one thing in the cell, goes, is this really the case?
Yeah.
And actually, when you started digging, we realized it wasn't the case. Anyway, I decided that in the end, I didn't really want to carry on working in that field because I was getting a bit, I found it difficult because of the safety, efficacy, this sort of balance you have to make a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, because when a drug's patented, they have to stick to the patent. They have to stick to how they said it originally worked. And of course, in a way, unfortunately, the system seems to sequester any further scientific investigation. But of course, science doesn't stand still. It just keeps moving on and on and on. So in the end, I decided to leave and set up by myself. Armed with this knowledge, I thought, well, can I start to get a few clients and look into much more deeply the mode of action of some of these drugs? And so I think, well, you know, maybe there are other benefits from these drugs and also potentially more side effects when you start looking at this. But when I set the company up, I was also looking around for clients. And this is serendipity. This is just how science sometimes works. My brother, who's older than me, and I spoke to some people in my family because some of them have been associated with medics and things. And I said, well, do you know anybody who might want a freelance consultant person working on a bit of science? And I thought, well, it's a bit of a long shot. And my brother actually then said, well, funny you should say that. One of my old college friends has done rather well for himself. And I thought, oh, okay, well, it could be interesting. And I said, who is this chap? And he said, Jeffrey Guy. And I kind of remembered him because he's obviously much older than, well, 7 years older than me, actually. It's not less now than it used to be. And so I gave him a call, went and saw him. And as it turned out, he'd just set up GW Pharmaceuticals. And he'd been quite successful as an entrepreneur. He's trained as a physician. But he said, yes, I'll be interested in you working for me. And I said, I've got a fundamental question for you, Alistair. And his question was, what's the role of bioenergetics, metabolism, with cannabis? Because they were trying to work out how it worked. And that set us off down a path where the knowledge I'd learned from previous things, and because he was funding me to have a look at this, gave me carte blanche just to look at everything in relation to cannabis. And it became very clear that the field of cannabis research was very biased towards endocannabinoids. Now, again, this is classic pharmacology. Someone discovered that one of the cannabinoids, tetrahydrocannabinol, bound to a receptor in the brain. And I thought, right, this explains absolutely everything. We were a bit skeptical. I mean, it certainly does explain some of it. Don't get me wrong, it's obviously doing something. Yeah. But when I started digging into the literature, the very first thing I looked for was, well, is there any evidence of these things binding to mitochondria? And the answer was yes.
Right.
And that's how we got into that. Now, during that time, we also started to ask the question, well, if they're not just binding to this receptor, and they're very old compounds, why is it that a compound from a plant seems to have some efficacy in an animal? It's a very straightforward question. Why would a plant grow a compound that helps a human or an animal or anything? And one of the things that we discovered when going through the literature, and the literature is huge, and there's often real buried treasure in there when you start to look for it, often in very, very obscure journals. And we discovered that there was this theory called xenohormesis, as by a guy called Lamming had come up with it. And basically, his suggestion was that plant stress compounds, now these are compounds which all plants contain, particularly when they're stressed, which is why they're called plant stress compounds, might somehow give a signal to an animal that, say, for instance, winter's coming on, and prepare it. And this was the concept of hormesis. And basically, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And the idea, this actually is not a new idea. It was Paracelsus first mentioned it, the dose makes the poison. And we started looking into it, and lo and behold, there was a whole pile of literature talking about this. And we thought, this makes a lot of sense. Now, how they're doing it is the really interesting part, but it does seem to be real. And because we were also still talking to my mate Jimmy, wasn't Imperial at the time, we said, well, can we start to think about this in terms of lifestyle? And a lot of people were saying, well, everybody needs to exercise. Universally accepted, Romans knew it, the Greeks knew it. We knew we have to exercise, or at least do a lot of physical activity. And we said, well, I wonder if one of the problems with being sedentary is just the lack of a hormetic stimulus, exercise. And that seems to be the case. So are these compounds working in a similar way? And this course led us down the whole pathway of, well, if cannabinoids are doing something in a human, could they be hormetic? And we presented this data years and years ago. I presented it at a meeting, and it went down like a lead balloon.
And anyway, we
got a little abstract, but it was just not something. And I'm thinking, well, hang on, what's going on here? Why is this concept so difficult to take? And we discovered this chap called Ed Calabrese, who's been single-handedly almost trying to promote hormesis. And he dug into this and discovered that the concept of what they call the not biphasic dose response was well described, had been for a long time, and people looked into in the 40s and 50s, and they discovered that small doses of poison on bacteria, for instance, rather than killing them, made them grow faster. And this turned out to be a lot of things, including, and this is the really interesting thing, that very, very low doses of radiation, for instance, could do the same thing. Yep. And so the scientists got on board with this, and they discovered, yes, there were pathways in the cell which reacted to mild stress and basically upregulated everything to make them stronger. And if you think about it from an evolutionary point of view, it makes perfect sense. We would never have evolved if we didn't adapt to our environment. And so this is the basic concept of hormesis. But of course, it's not something that everybody likes, because if within this whole process, and this is, so I'm going to be a bit controversial here, is, of course, if you've got a drug, any kind of drug, it will have a dose response. Now, and for a long time, and this is where the science, and this is, again, I think this is a topic for a separate subject, but it was thought for a long time, because of the various personalities, that there wasn't really the drugs and not many compounds didn't really have an effect at a low dose. And they call this the linear response, no threshold model, which the pharmaceutical industry kind of adopted. But of course, if you then say, oh, well, everything's kind of could have to be hormetic, what it would imply is that every drug at some level, I will have an opposite effect at a very low dose and be very seriously toxic at a high dose. Now, of course, we know that that's the case for a lot of drugs. Paracetamol is one of the prime examples. It's you would never get it marketed today because so above a certain dose, it's extremely toxic. Because it, you know, but it's not toxic in a way you would it's as obvious. You know, because if you have too much of it, you think, oh God, I've had too much paracetamol, and that 3 or 4 days later, your liver packs up.
Yeah.
And so, this is the kind of thing. So there's, and this is still something which is not fully accepted across the medical world, and indeed. When I've tried to publish papers on hormesis or work on hormesis, you often get reviewers feeling very, very, that they are very skeptical, but a bit wary of it, because it's like it's a kind of almost a toxic word. Like toxicity itself is a toxic word.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's how we got into it, and it became very clear. Then when we started looking at through the literature, lots of other compounds, we realised that a lot of plant compounds do the same thing. And we found a lot of evidence, certainly in the old literature, and this is interesting, because again, this is all about science philosophy. We found in the old literature, there were papers looking at mitochondrial function in cannabis, and there's quite a few of them. But it kind of all petered out, because in the 1980s, someone discovered the receptor. And of course, the pharmacologists went, oh yeah, this explains everything. And so research into the mitochondria kind of disappeared, didn't completely disappear, but went very quiet. And of course, nobody's really looking at it. And we got back into it, and we started doing research in the lab. And I certainly showed that I could see that these cannabinoids were affecting mitochondrial function. Again, we had problems with funding on it, but I won't go into details on that. That's not really for this call. But it's clear that other people are beginning to understand this. But of course, you have to ask the question: why is it they're modulating mitochondrial function? And it turns out that if you look through the literature, quite a few compounds from plants do. Resveratrol seems to, berberine, curcumins, curcuminoids. They all seem to somewhere along the line. Now, this then brings in another really fascinating aspect of medicine. Now, I mentioned it earlier. Is this, why is it that a plant compound helps a human? You think, well, this comes back to the stress thing again.
Yeah.
You think, well, actually, that makes perfect sense. If a plant is stressed, it needs to respond to whatever's going on. And it seems, certainly from the plant aspect, these compounds you find in plants, and they're often phenolic. They have this phenol aromatic backbone in them. But it's not, they don't always have to be phenols. They can be other sort of circular structures, and even very unsaturated structures. But these have some very interesting properties. But it seems that this seems to be a general thing that land plants in particular, but also algae, have evolved over millions and millions and millions of years. And one of the properties of many of these compounds, and we looked into this and went, oh, this must be a property, is that, of course, they absorb light. And some of the earliest theories on why plants contain these, what they call secondary metabolites, was that, of course, they act as sunscreens. And plants are exposed to sun all the time. Now, what the interesting thing about these compounds, and this I'm doing them generally now, this isn't just cannabis, this is, there are thousands and thousands of these compounds, but often quite, they look similar.
Mm.
Like 3-methyl chicken wire, as we used to call it, but they all seem to have similar properties, or at least some of the similar properties. And what's fascinating is you can have a compound, potentially it can act as a sunscreen, but the plant also uses it to control its own immune system, or its symbol equivalent to a plant immune system. It can kill cells, and interestingly, it also can be antiviral and antibacterial. Now, put those compounds into a human, and they do some of the same things. Now, you then go back and say, well, okay, how can one compound do all of this? And this is the really fascinating question to me. You know, because, for instance, cannabis is classically, it's been looked at as anti-spasticity in multiple sclerosis. But of course, people swear that it's anti-inflammatory properties. certainly evidence of anti-cancer activity, and we now know that they have quite good antimicrobial activity, and indeed antiviral, and certainly people were looking at that in the COVID thing. But this is a common thing. So how is it one compound does all of these things? Now, the first question, of course, first up thing is it potentially hormetic, in the sense that they stimulate a stress adaptive response. And I suppose if I had to pin my thinking on what's the mechanism, it's simply that they are causing a similar process in animals, which is very interesting because it suggests something very, very ancient is in common between plants and animals. You know, there's a common metabolism. And of course, what is the common metabolism? Bioenergetics.
Yeah. It seems to come back to this idea of the dissipative structure, which is sort of necessary for complex systems to self-organize, as far as I'm aware. And feel free to jump in if I get something wrong.
That's the theory I was about to get onto, which is the one obviously you want me to talk about. Yeah.
Yeah.
The story then goes, and this is the story, which is that we started going, well, this is really interesting, and you know, what does this all mean? And we then did a step change in thinking. And I'm just trying to, sorry, it's a potted history life story, but one of the things we started to realize, well, we need to look into this. And one of the names that popped up in our research with consistency was this chap Nick Lane, Professor Nick Lane from UCL. And he's written a series of really good books, mostly about mitochondria, because we got really into this. But in one of the books, he does mention this possibility that quantum mechanics could be involved in how electrons move around in mitochondria. And that got us really thinking. And it also got me thinking a bit, well, if it's just quantum mechanics, what about thermodynamics? And this said, well, actually, okay, let's think about this from a different aspect. Because Nick talks a lot about origins of life. And that sent me off down a completely different track, which was, oh, origins of life. Never really thought about that. So if you think about this, we all originated from a common ancestor, which had a common beginning. And so what is that process? And as you say, This actually leads straight back to the idea of thermodynamics and self-organization, because there has to be a fundamental law in the universe about why life started. And the best one I've come across, and I there's nothing else I've seen comes close yet, is this idea of, as you say, dissipative self-organization, which is basically that nature absolutely abhors a potential. And it seems that if you've got an energy potential, the laws of entropy basically say the best way of dissipating that entropy is to get organized into a structure and then dissipate that energy. That's probably the simplest way I can describe it, which basically says that all life is an advanced dissipating structure, and which will be subject to things like natural selection, and which of course brings us back into another subject, which I'm sure you're interested in, which is inflammation. So that's how we got into that. And when we started looking into this, of course, we then again, the literature is full of new old ideas. People were talking about this years and years and years ago. It just never really took off. But another thing also popped into our field. And this came in a bit later, because when we started looking into this, we thought, well, here's cannabis and here's thermodynamics and here's quantum. Then what happened, as people do, is that Jeffrey Guy sold his company. He wanted to retire. Obviously, made a bit of dosh along the way. And we were talking to each other, and he said, well, what are we going to do after? And he wants to do something, because Jeffrey's very much the consummate scientist. He's fascinated by everything. And one of the things that we started to get really interested in was quantum mechanics. Now, therein hangs yet another story as to how that started. one of the angles was Nick Lane, but I was at the time working in the laboratory, and we were looking into how to study cannabis in live cells. One of the techniques we were using is this thing called two-photon microscopy. This enables you to study in great detail insides of cells. You can look at fluorescence, you can look at compounds which fluoresce. And we were looking at mitochondrial structure, actually, and what cannabis did to mitochondrial structure. And I had this idea, which we're going to repeat, about how we could actually see a cannabis, or at least cannabidiol, inside a cell. I won't go into the details because we're still trying to do it. But one of the things was we started to realize that the techniques we were using were effectively frying the cell. Now, we started to use UV light. And actually, one of the things that you can do with cells is this business is called autofluorescence. And this is where you shine a light of a certain frequency of light, in this case, a light of around 340 nanometers, which is what we call UVB B, so BC, not quite visible, it's a blue end. And there's a molecule in the cell called NADH. Now, anybody who's into biochemistry will know all about NADH. And it's one of these compounds that, oh, yeah, we know NADH, yeah, it's in biology. And again, it's one of these things where you go, okay, this is interesting. And we start to think, well, why is this light causing damage to cells? Now, it's well known that there's this thing called phototoxicity. But what's really interesting about NADH is that, of course, it's a key molecule in the movement of electrons through the cell. I mean, it's absolutely fundamental. It's an ancient molecule, very old. It's been around since whenever life has probably been around. Interestingly enough, a lot of its precursors can be made abiotically, so asteroids and all sorts of things. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating when you start going down that road. But one of the things it does do is, apart from fluorescing, which enables us to look at mitochondria, because it fluoresces and you can actually image them, of course, it starts to emit electrons. And this got us thinking, so, well, hang on. Okay, so here we have a molecule in the cell, which is one of the most important redox, as they call the molecules in the cell, which fluoresces, absorbs photons, and emits electrons. Does this mean anything? Is it just a spurious finding or not? Well, we don't think it is. We think it's very important because we now know that UV light has massive effects on mitochondrial function. We know we can tune mitochondria using this process. And so it goes from just being, oh, well, this is a simple biochemical problem that, oh, gosh, we can't do microscopy because we just fry the cells, to actually, why is this affecting the cell? And this got us back to the quantum thing, because, of course, you can look at it from a quantum structure because it carries electrons. It's got basically double bonds and, you know, rings and things in it. And this led us down the road to realization that life is actually full of what we call chromophoric molecules. These are molecules that absorb light. And then when you look into, and here's the obviousness of this thing. Biochemistry 101, when I was at university in the 1980s, we talked about the electron transport chain and the cytochromes. Now, stop and think about that for 5 seconds. What's a cytochrome? It's a compound in the cell that has color, i.e. the most fundamental process in all biology contains these molecules which absorb light.
Yeah.
Now, stop and think about that for a few minutes. You go, well, is that just serendipity again, or is there something else going on? And so this led us down to thinking, well, actually, you then combine this with the ideas that people have been thinking about for a long time, that biology in particular could be using quantum mechanics in a way which perhaps is more than we thought. Now, this is the field of quantum biology, of course. And suddenly, here we have the most fundamental process in nature or biology where it transfers electrons, and in this particular case, it uses it to produce a proton gradient, is based on these molecules that absorb light and, interestingly enough, channel electrons, carry electrons. Then throw in the next thing we came across, of course, these electrons are spin. They have spin, so they're affected by magnetic fields. And this led us in like another direction. And this direction was absolutely fascinating because, again, this is serendipity. Jeffrey and I went to a meeting in Seattle, 2015 it was. And it was speed dating for scientists and very rich people. And we actually, it's run by Alan, the Allen Institute, as in Microsoft. And basically what happens is scientists pitch ideas to people with money about, you know, research. But one of the talks really, really resonated with us, and that resonates probably a good word. And it was a talk by a chap called Mike Levine. You probably can remember Mike Levine. Most people have now.
Yep.
And his talk, I'm sure Mike won't mind me saying this, didn't go down particularly well. We were in this big auditorium and all these people in there. And he was talking about this idea of bioelectric fields. And Jeffrey and I looked at another and went, oh, this is interesting. I wonder what this means. Anyway, straight after, we went and found him in the bar and said, Mike, do tell us more. And we ended up working with Mike. But of course, he was saying, making this point, that maybe that information is held in bioelectric fields. And then you go back into science again, you go back into the literature, and then suddenly you look back and go back to the days of you know, Volta, Galvani. And of course, scientists back 200 years ago were saying, well, life is electrical. Okay, it was an argument of whether it was electrical or whether it should be a biologist or a physicist talking about it. And that, again, is another story in itself. But it made the point. And suddenly, oh, this is not new at all. This is not new at all. And then the next interesting link came, because we were thinking about, well, if we've got these chromophoric molecules in cells, what does that mean? And then, of course, we came across this field of biophoton emission. And that cells, through biological chemiluminescence, effectively, this seem to produce very low levels of photons, which is research we're looking into now. And we came across Popp, who was the guy involved. But one of the people we came across was, of course, Gerwich, Alexander Gerwich. And this is a chap who did, who was doing research back in the turn of the century, so the 19th, 20th century, because at the time, the one of the strongest theories on biological shape was electric fields. You know, what to term, or to, what determines shape, how you regenerate, you know, why is a foot, an eye, an eye, etc. Because don't forget, nobody knew anything about genes at this point. And it was basically the, what they call the mitogenetic field idea. And he was looking for this field. He's thinking, well, what could it be, electrical? And he did his famous onion experiment, which people may or may not have heard of. Very simply, he, for reasons, which just shows how intuitive some of these people were, took one onion, put a big quartz plate between it and another onion, and cut the roots of one onion, and discovered that the roots of the next onion started to grow faster, and realized that, is this what we call the mitogenetic radiation? Mitogenesis, but mitosis, basically. And that triggered off that field. But again, it was one of those fields that never really took off. But of course, then you start to put these things together. And of course, you've got the electric field idea, you've got the photon field idea. And then we come bumbling into it, along with plenty of other people, going, oh, and discover there was a whole underground people looking at this.
Yeah.
And you know, this is how mainstream science often swamps some really interesting stuff. And in the end, and this is what led to us setting up the Guy Foundation, also the foundation, to facilitate the research into this. And so we went from the hormesis idea into thermodynamics, into quantum mechanics, into the origins of life, and via all these different fields. And one of the things we do with the Guy Foundation is we facilitate these meetings where we have, and we invite people from very different disciplines. And we're getting people now talking who are, you know, dyed-in-the-wool physicists, talking dyed-in-the-wool biologists, and discovering they've actually got a lot of common ground.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is back to this polymath approach. And it, you know, and it is making us realise that there's a whole other side to biology which really does need to be explored. And, of course, well, I think what you're interested in, of course, is, well, OK, yeah, this is great, but how does this relate to hormesis inflammation? But, of course, absolutely it does.
Mm.
Because when you take on board the hormesis idea and you think about this, is there an underlying principle here? And the answer is yes, there is. We think through thermodynamics. And indeed, people are now doing these studies, working out that if you think about hormesis, you can make the argument, well, actually, it's just a response, and it's an adaptive response, which probably does fall out of thermodynamics. But the interesting thing, it's through natural selection. And this is where we get the idea of inflammation. And I think this is what you're probably,
I mean, I've been thinking about inflammation as, you know, it's often said as something that you want to avoid. You know, you want to avoid inflammation, but the way that I see it is that inflammation is basically an effort by the body to seek novel states of quasi-stability. Because when you're inflamed, it's basically the body dissipating in order to find new ways of being ordered in a complex way to be adaptive. And that sort of ties back to this natural selection thing. It's always looking to be the most adaptive at any point in time, because the environmental stimulus that you're exposed to changes from moment to moment. So you never get this stability. It's always this quasi-stability. From that point of view, I mean, how do you look at things that sort of curtail inflammation? I know, you know, things like you mentioned, paracetamol and ibuprofen, things that people take quite regularly that are specifically preventing the body from expressing the inflammation that might be repairing or basically curating the body to become adapted again. You know, what kind of impact could this have if you're basically disturbing the natural tendency of the body to be inflamed in order to resolve the issue?
Yeah, I think the way to look at this is one of the papers we published, but this idea that exactly as you say, that inflammation, one way of describing it, it's the body's way of just looking through phase space to find a solution.
And
it's the flip side of hormesis. Now, what is hormesis at the extreme level? Well, it ends up being inflammation. Now, you see, of course, this is where conventional phraseology and the way people talk about it kind of muddies the waters. You know, we're all brought up inflammation. What does it mean? It basically means inflammatory, which is heat, yep. And it's inflammation. So it's about heat. And that's how the word came about, because when you were damaged or you had an infection, you got warm. And yep. That's thermodynamics in action. But, you know, the cellular level, what's going on is the body's going, oh, something's wrong, I've got to rebuild. And, of course, this goes back to bioelectricity too, because that's one mm-hmm. of the things, electricity is involved in the whole thing. But you're absolutely right. Me, inflammation just seems to be this process where the system is, and this is the key point, if the stimulus is too damaging, it takes out information that it has to rebuild. Mm-hmm. And in the process, it will quite happily remove systems that don't work. Now, this, of course, leads into something else, which is a bit of a taboo subject, and this is the principle of death. Death becomes us. And this goes back to what I was saying about apoptosis. When apoptosis, I notice it's slightly off to one side, but you'll see why I want to go down this path. For ages, nobody understood how it was that our immune systems worked. And what it boils down to is, in the end, it's natural selection, because the system, for instance, if you're exposed to an antigen or something, it goes through an enormous set of cells until one that fits. Now, what happens to all those other cells, or what happens to damaged cells? Nobody knew, because they just seem to disappear, but they commit programmed cell death. There is a built-in death program, and proper apoptosis, you won't hardly see it. It's non-inflammatory, it just removes damaged components. So, and the interesting thing is you now realize, and they now know, that of course apoptosis isn't just applicable to multicellular animals with complex systems like us, but to bacteria. They age and they will commit suicide. So death is ancient. And if you then link that to thermodynamics and this idea of dissipation, self-organization, and network theory, you start to, and then there's a few papers that talk about this. I can't go into the mass because I don't fully understand it. But the point they make is that you will end up with a system which will delete nodes in a network to ensure the other nodes survive. This seems totally mathematical. And so death is purely down to a mathematical process. If something is going wrong, it gets removed. Now, in terms of inflammation, that makes perfect sense, because if you get damaged, you don't want those damaged cells. If they're broken or they can't, for instance, deal with the reactive oxygen, so they produce lots of reactive oxygen, they are highly damaging, so they get removed. The same process, of course, is pivotal in activating the very same system. So you have to have a feedback mechanism. Mm-hmm. Inflammation, if you look at it purely from biological thing, is you get damage, you get all these signals produced, usually based on reactive oxygen species or damaged components, damaged mitochondria, trigger, all sorts of things. That triggers the system saying, we've been damaged, we have to repair. And it, for a while, it becomes a feed-forward system. It amplifies very quickly. The problem is that sometimes, and maybe particularly as you get older, the feedback negative system doesn't work as well as it should do. And this then can lead to a chronic spiral of, you know, like a death spiral or a chronic inflammation.
Yeah.
Now, the really interesting thing here, and this is what I think the breakthrough, I mean, it hasn't been universally accepted, is that the way to look at inflammation isn't the old way of inflammation in you or I, but at a global level. And by that, I mean in all of life on Earth. Life on Earth, if we go back to thermodynamic theory, is a mechanism. Life is simply a way of accelerating entropy. And it has to explore phase space all the time. So if we then go scale free, and this is kind of, Mike Levine talks about scale free stuff too. Inflammation happens at all levels in life, from the molecular all the way up to entire species. And if you stand back, this is a bit of a Gaia hypothesis. James Lovelock would have loved this idea. Well, I'd love to have discussed this with him. But then you can see extinction of species, loss of species, aging as part of that adaptive process. Because if something doesn't work, it gets removed. Now, for humans, that looks terrible. But, you know, if we get hit by a meteorite, a big asteroid or an asteroid tomorrow, who's going to survive? It won't be the advanced species. It'll be the small species replicating very quickly because they're exploring the new phase based on how to survive in this new environment. Bigger things like us won't survive because we're not adaptive enough. But that's a good thing because it just gets rid of us because we're clogging the system up now. And if you look at inflammation in that way, you can see that within a single multicellular organism like us, that is exactly what's happening. When you get, you know, for instance, when you get a cut, what happens? A lot of cells die. You get a massive generation of inflammatory mediators, all based around reactive oxygen, usually, because you get damage. All sorts of things get damaged. A lot of cells will die. A lot of them will get removed quite deliberately and then die. But new ones will come in, and these will be the fitter ones, and they will close the wound, and the system will hopefully eventually resolve. But as you get older, that process gets less and less efficient. And what seems to be happening is we're losing fidelity and memory of how to do that. And eventually it gets to a point where we can't do it at all and we die. And this raises some very interesting questions about what aging, whether or not, for instance, you know, there's a lot of people in the world think that we can extend absolute lifespan of humans. And this is one of the big unknown questions at the moment is how do we control aging? Not within our lifetime, but within, you know, evidence is that no human is likely to live much beyond 120. And very few get past 110, actually. There's just too much. The numbers are too big to say that anything else is going on. Loads of animals, well, most species do the same thing. So what is that limit and why does it happen in us? It's probably through evolution. We know that species, you know, Greenland sharks, things do live longer, but an awful lot don't. And so those that seem to be immortal actually change all the time. Planaria, classic, you know, the worm, the little flatworms. They almost immortal, but are they immortal in the sense that the individual survives? Maybe they do. But the interesting thing is, and if you talk to Mike Levine, this is because they have a field memory, which can, you know, you can chop the head off or the tail off, they'll grow a new head and tail and seem to have the same information. So it's not genetic.
No, it's not genetic at all. So, and I think I think what's interesting is you brought up this idea of the fidelity. Of the signal, and you know, as structure breaks down, function breaks down, and vice versa. And you know, we talk about this sort of organizing principle when you have fields, because there's still this big question of morphogenesis. You can't really explain it with genes, and of course, the way that we're taught at university is that genes sort of explain everything, whereas you know, genes code for proteins, and you know, if you say morphology is based on the genes, it's like saying you know what a house looks like just by knowing what the bricks are.
It's kind
of ridiculous.
It's a very good analogy. Yeah. And I think this is you're absolutely right. And I think this is because this goes back to the origins idea. I published a paper a while back where we said, well, if it is electric fields, then those fields must have been important in the origins of life. And I think Mike is on board with this. I think I'm, you know, I've discussed this with Nick Lane, but I think we you know, he kind of thinks it's probably right too. We don't know. But the point about this is, and this is the point I would make, you've got to go back to basics again. You know, this is that the big issue at the moment, and I think, like, you know, the Rumfoldisms, you know, there's too many unknown unknowns, you know, kind of thing. But one of the unknowns, of course, is the origins of life. And I think if we nailed that, I think we would have a much better understanding of biology. But as Nick Lane and co say, actually, current life explains how it started because we reflect how we started, the proton gradient being one of the prime ones in electron transport. But if that's absolutely correct, then it does suggest, and you take the thermodynamics, that life must have started in some kind of self-organizing dissipating structure.
Yeah.
And what are the most fundamental particles in the universe? Well, electrons and protons. And which basically suggests that's how we have to view it. And if they're moving, then you're creating charge, then you have electric fields. And everything, and this is a point that I think, again, isn't really taught. When you look inside a cell, everything is charged. You have proteins have their own electrical charge. Water can show dipole changes. Membranes are highly charged because what you're doing is you're pumping ions, electrons and protons across them all the time. And even a membrane itself, when you look at the fine structure of a membrane, it's polarized. And so if you change the field, you get effectively a kind of capacitor. You get a capacitance. So you get this, what they call electrostriction. Membranes are constantly changing, but they're constantly charged. And this is, you know, this is one of the quotes that Nick Lane makes, which really got us into this. And again, hadn't really thought of it. You look at the charge across the mitochondrial membrane, it's in the order of 30 million volts.
Yeah.
Stop and think about that for a few seconds. Now.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's because the gap between the charges is so small.
But it's still huge.
Yeah, it's like a bolt of lightning, as he says.
Yeah, electrodynamically, it is massive. And, you know, there are people talking about the electrodynamics of, you know, and it's, again, it's a subject which isn't really, really, really taken off. But again, you know, if you talked, I suspect if you talked to Galvini, if we could, you know, dig him up and talk to him now, he would go, yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
And I find this absolutely fascinating, the way science has gone off in different directions. But yeah, you're absolutely right. But of course, that then brings in a whole other idea about self-organization and dissipation. Of course, it's the movement of energy and charge, which is the dissipation of energy.
So how does this help us think about, you know, because the fact that we are a conglomerate of trillions of cells and they're all sort of working together as a whole, it's quite unbelievable in some sense to think that they're all cooperating and they all know what every other one is doing. And, you know, it makes me wonder about long-range coherence and, you know, sort of the birth of multicellularity in general. And, you know, how do we achieve long-range coherence? And I think Rhys Mould has been doing great work in looking at biophotons as sort of collectively organizing mitochondria. They all speak to each other, I guess, in inverted commas, through biophoton emission. But, you know, you wonder about the electric fields within the cell. And I know water has quite a high dielectric constant. Yes. And I believe it can be structured by electric fields quite easily. I wonder, is water another way in which you can sort of achieve this long-range coherence between cells, you know, perhaps by the strength of the fields? And then, you know, when mitochondria don't work as well, the field drops and you get maybe a loss of coherence. Is that something that sort of makes sense?
This is an old idea, the Frohlich idea, what they call Frohlich condensates. And idea of electric fields interacting. And Rhys Mould's one of our postdocs, you know, we're funding his research. And, you know, but this idea that mitochondria producing electric fields, and Doug Wallace, the other great mitochondrial expert, is on board with this on this one as well. And if you think about the charge movement, then Chris, you are clearly creating big electric fields. Now, those effects have numerous ways of acting in biology. There's a direct, as you said, potentially field effect. But of course, the charge difference also manipulates and controls all the proteins in your cell. Now, this is something that was known for quite a long time, is that when you look inside the cell, now one of the techniques I used to use when I was working in the lab was electrophoresis. But molecules in the cell move by electrophoresis. The charge across the membrane or through the cell, if you've got a protein with different charges, you can move it around based on that charge. You know, it just follows the charge. You know, if it's negatively charged, it will go towards a positive, you know, area, etc. So that process is kind of known, but of course nobody's really went, but what else is the charge doing? And I think the water question is a really interesting one, because this has always been the sort of the darling of astrobiology, is, you know, will life only occur with water? And I think the recent, they've got stuff from the Bennu asteroid, and they've now found that not only are there aromatic compounds on it and amino acids, and they're going, this has got, I hope it is real, they haven't contaminated, but I think it's all real. They've also shown evidence of saline and water on it, you know, and the thing. And so, of course, and certainly everybody, and I think this is probably the case, that water probably is important, because water is, we're actually holding, the Gaia Foundation, we're actually holding a series of water in the spring. It's proving quite tricky to get organised, actually. You're surprised. But it is absolutely fascinating, because water has some really interesting physics about it. the DARPA being one of them. And they talk about things called Debye screening and things like this. But of course, its structure changes very quickly when you put ions in it. Of course, water in biology is full of ions. And so it has some absolutely fascinating properties. And one of the ones, as you suggest, is this idea that within two or three radiuses of a water molecule, you can actually get ordered water. And if you think about it, it makes perfect sense. Water is it's a charged ion. It has positive electric. Stick that in an electric field, what's it going to do? Well, it's going to do something really interesting, which is exactly what we think is going on near the membrane and potentially around proteins as well. There's an area of what they call interfacial water, which is a whole area of new research which people are trying to look at because it's very difficult to research because you try and study something like that inside a cell. But the theory does suggest that it certainly is the case, and certainly long-range water ordering could be important. But the other thing which may be going on is, of course, if you have this kind of order, do you actually get quantum coherence? And you get this idea, potentially, can you increase the distance that molecules tunnel? And this is what we call electron tunneling, and this is pure quantum mechanics. To try and describe it simply, those of you who are into quantum mechanics will know that every particle, well, everything small, can either be described as a wave or a particle. And certainly, Young back in his day and other people showed that, wave light, for instance, is a wave or a particle. It only becomes a particle when we observe it. This goes into deep quantum physics, but this is the way of particle duality. But what we also know now is you can look at much bigger molecules and show there are waves. And they've done this with molecules up to the size of porphyrin, so hundreds and hundreds of atoms. And the matter, I think it's matter inference they're using for this. Point about it is real. Now the question is what is going on inside a cell at that level? And people would say, oh, it's too warm and wet. And this has always been the issue with quantum mechanics physicists talking to biologists, and it used to be the case, well, look, quantum mechanics only happens at the very small level and very cold. Well, the truth is it happens all the time. Clearly it does, because we wouldn't be here if it didn't. But one of the really interesting things is the very, and this is the kind of thinking now, is this idea of induced vibronics resonance, is that the environment induces resonance within the cell. And so you end up with areas of coherence within the cell through vibrational resonance. And if this is correct, it means that biology has, over time, well, it's always been that way, evolved to use that as a mechanism to say, just in moving the electron an extra 10, 3 or 4 nanometers through tunneling. And if it can do that, through biochemical coherence, that has a massive effect on how biochemistry works. And so, yes, and water probably is absolutely pivotal to that. And I suspect there's a great deal more to learn about water than we understand at the moment. So you're absolutely
And
right.
yeah, well, it's always sort of been an idea of mine that if the mitochondria are not efficiently, if the flux of charged particles is impeded in some way, which it often is in chronic disease, that the field is going to drop. And when the field drops, the impact of that globally within the cell are going to be quite large. And I think this is something, I think it was a 2014 paper by Mike Levine. And one of his PhDs looking at what oncogenic mutations actually do, and it seems that what they do is break down sort of the gap junctions and the it perturbs the charge of the cell, which actually causes the type of growth that we are familiar with as cancer. And I think really what that comes down to is, cancer is a cell that sort of lost communication. It's lost its identity in a sense, and it starts to grow as a single-celled organism would again, where it's focusing on movement and replication because it can no longer grasp that it's in the field of a greater whole.
Well, this you see, this raises a really interesting question. I've actually talked to Mike a bit about this, but they is. You know, we this again is how conventional biochemistry or even microbiology tends to bias your opinion. And if you look back through history, and I'm talking 3 billion years, the evidence is that bacterial colonies and archaean colonies, and I point out here that there's two major kingdoms of prokaryotes. One is bacteria, the other is archaeans, and they are quite different, but they do the same thing. And the importance of that, it can't be underestimated, because of course one of those got together with the other one to generate the modern cell, and the bacterium became the mitochondrion. The outside of the cell became was the archaeum. And that's and this, so this, but the key here is cooperation. And my suspicion is that cooperation was there right at the beginning of life. It's not the unusual, it's the norm. And there would have been circumstances, and this is where environments changed, where there was a necessity for single cells to start swimming around and going away from the main bulk, because otherwise the species would die out. So there was a selection process going on where it was advantageous to be on your own. And that, now, if you start to think about bioelectric fields, this begins to make a great deal of sense, because if, and this is a big if you take the origins of life, say it happened in an alkaline thermal vent, other theories are available, of course. There's a whole other story to go there, but I tend to support the Nick Lane Russell Martin Russell ideas of thermal vents, simply because it just seems logical.
Yes, I
Again, not
agree.
very good scientific, I know, but it's where you get the flow of energy. You've got a big potential, you've got the flow of energy, but of course they will be creating electric fields. Now, if as Nick is suggesting, is that you've got these crystalline structures within a thermal vent, you've got millions of little crystalline, they're like tiny little cells. What's going to happen? Well, maybe they all cooperated to begin with. So being on your own is very unusual. So cancer, and this brings us back to one of the big unknown, unanswered questions at the moment, is what is cancer? Now, we describe it, but as Mike points out, and I think he's on the right lines with this one, is it's just a lack of cooperation. But there's a reason why they don't cooperate. There must be some fundamental switch, and we know there's a switch because we've got oncogenes and things, and the various things do get activated, where the cell suddenly goes, I don't want to belong here, I'm going to go off and do my own thing. But now, the interesting thing about cancer is when you look at what happens from when it grows to metastasize and then goes somewhere else. You've probably heard of the Warburg theory, the idea that, mitochondria are dysfunctional in cancer. Not at all. They're fully functional. They're just doing different things. And they get modulated to do what the cell needs them to do. So, for instance, if you're a tumor and it gets a bit anoxic, you switch off oxidative phosphorylation and go towards aerobic glycolysis or something. When you want to move, you reactivate your mitochondria so you can wander about, go out through the go out through into an artery somewhere and then wander off around the body. But the only way you can survive is you have to find the right niche. And I think that's fascinating because, we know this idea of metastasis is based on where the tumor is going to go. And there's also some evidence, I think, and I don't know if I'm correct on this, that tumors, as they grow, start to send out extracellular vesicles and other bits and pieces, which seem to prepare other niches around the body for implantation. Now, this is now you start thinking about what happens, for instance, when you have fertilization. But then you think about go back to a thermal vent. What happened with the thermal vent? What happened when it changed? What would you do? How would you evolve? How would you survive? Some very interesting parallels with all of that. And then you throw in the electric field idea too. And so, yeah, and I think I think this is the next big change in biology, because back to the meeting I mentioned in Seattle where we met Mike Levine. There was a group there. They wanted to sequence the entire world genome, every single organism. And Jeffrey and I sat there and went, yeah, right. And Paul Allen, we're actually sitting next to Paul Allen at this point. He's still alive then. And he kind of thought, well, this is a lot of money for what we're going to learn.
Yeah, exactly. I
Yeah,
thought
and
we
you've got
would
to
have
think,
learned
you're
from the
missing the
first
point.
time.
And genetics is really important, don't get me wrong, but it's only part of the puzzle. You're
Exactly.
absolutely right. What do genes do? Well, they just memorize how to make a brick. And that's what biology is, because if you then go back through time, and this is why understanding the origins of life is so important. As you probably know, there's a big discussion over was it genes first or metabolism first? And my suspicion is it's metabolism. I may be shot down in flames for saying that. But I think again that genes came along probably quite quickly, but a bit later. And there is some evidence of how that might have happened. But the RNA genetics first one is, I find it more difficult. Doesn't mean it's not important, but the sequence of things happening. But that, of course, does mean that, I don't know, did you ever watch any of the Star Trek movies?
No, I didn't.
Well, there's one movie, I can't remember which one it is, and that Kirk and the crew are sent off to investigate this spacecraft, which is terrorizing the galaxy. And they come up against this entity and they go, oh, what is it? What is it? And it's heading towards Earth. Anyway, they get onto it. And And at the center of it is Voyager. And the point they make is that Voyager triggers off this, like, a galactic clusterization of this machinery, which grows into this whole entity. But, and the point about it is, it just follows a simple program. And I thought it was a very clever idea, you know. But the point about it is, of course, when you look at life started very simply, and if you think it started from something like a flow of electron or hydrogen to carbon dioxide, the chemistry, I think, is quite clear. Or you get this formation of autocatalytic networks, which accelerate the dissipation of energy, you get more and more complexity. And that seems to be quite real. This happens quite quickly. We know we can make membranes. All of this can happen abiotically. You don't need any biology at all. The chemistry's there. We know how it works. And so it does happen. It clearly happens on asteroids. It happens in interstellar space. So that happens quite naturally. So the question, of course, is there, well, how do you go forward with that? Well, how do you end up being more dissipative? Well, you build, you evolve more complex molecules. Of course, proteins are the classic one. And what do? All they do is just reinforce something that's already there. Now, if you look at the basic components of the electron transport chain, it contains iron sulfides. And the thinking is these were there right at the beginning. And these have some very interesting quantum structures. You know, they transfer electrons and protons and things. And they're fundamental to life. And so when we go back far enough, we see some very simple constructs which don't need huge proteins to work. They probably are very inefficient. I mean, you know, but as time goes forward, these things, and the thing they do, and this is something called the cycle of brilliant. They take on information. Again, this is the maths, and they build and hoover up information. And that information then enables them to adapt more and more and more. And so cooperation, of course, is a natural way to go. You know, and this is what the point is. You know, one cell's quite smart, 10 and smarter, 2 trillion are really smart. And that's the point that Mike Levine makes, is that intelligence, again, is this very loaded term. But it's adaptability. It's about taking information and using that information, if you have a boundary, to adapt to what changes. You know, this goes back to Shannon theory and all sorts of things. Again, the maths behind it is solid. You know, there's some good solid maths there. And so you can see how even a single organism would then, its preference would be to work and cooperate because it would survive longer. And because it survives longer, it gets bigger, it burns through more energy, and it can replicate, producing more success of its successful copies of itself, which burns through more energy. And, you know, it's been said that, for instance, plants are just a natural way of dissipating solar potential. But they are. That's all they do. They take solar energy, a bit of carbon dioxide and water, and turn it into more plant, which is a way of dissipating energy. Matter is a way of dissipating energy. We then come along, animals come along, eat it, and dissipate it even further.
Something that's been interesting to me that I think about when you mention plant hormetic compounds again is that there's sort of this gradient that we experience on Earth where more plant hormetic compounds are generally available closer to the equator. I mean, once you get beyond 60 degrees from the equator, you know, plants don't really grow, at least for a large portion of the year.
They still have these compounds, but it's a difficult one to dissect that, because the closer to the equator, the more energy you've got, the more competition you've got. If you're a single plant living on the side of a Himalayan mountainside, the only competition you've got is from another plant or a goat. Living in the Amazon jungle, it's very different.
I guess the idea that I've been thinking about is that, you know, we experience all of these different gradients of the environmental signals that we receive, and this comes from everything from, you know, the weak magnetic fields from the Earth shift from the equator to the poles, you know, availability of nutrients, even these plant hormetic compounds, you know, has a gradient generally from the equator to the poles. You know, even things like the relative abundance of hydrogen isotopes, you know, the closer to the poles, the less deuterium you get, for example. And it seems to me as though all of these things sort of yoke together and sort of basically provide a coherent picture of information to an organism and let it know how to respond, how to be best adaptive in that situation. And it makes me wonder what the ramifications of something like, you know, eating imported foods from, you know, that have compounds that can't grow in the environmental givens that you might be living in, potentially causing a bit of disruption to the information that your body is getting. Is this something that, you know, you had considered, the fact that all of these gradients might be working together?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. I mean, that's where you know, your where you've evolved comes from, or where you've lived comes from. Yeah. But, I mean, I'll just throw in here that, you know, one of the questions you're raising here is about, you know, one of the questions you asked me at the beginning is, well, you know, how do plant compounds work? Well, we suggested that one of the things they actually do is modulate dissipation.
Yeah.
Is the you know, if we look at capture, sorry, just to go back to it, but I think it's relevant to what you are, the question you're asking, because of course, you know, if you're stressed, what do you need to do? Well, you need to explore phase space, but you also need to survive. You've got to maintain dissipation, because dissipation is how you maintain your structure. If you don't dissipate, you don't have structure.
Yeah.
It falls to pieces, you know, because there's no reason for it to be there. You know, life would not have evolved in a warm little pond suggested by Darwin, because it was, well, there was no stress. There was no energy.
Yeah.
There. You needed something pretty violent, you know, lightning or a hot thermal vent or something to get it going. And the same process is there now. And so my suspicion is, and we've published on this, is that the plant compounds are stress compounds, and they tune the system to maintain dissipation under extremes. So one of the things that we know is important, and it's been suggested for a long time, that the best time, for instance, to eat grapes, which contain resveratrol, which has been the darling of the research, you know, the longevity brigade for a long time, is actually during the autumn when they get cold, because that's when the plants produce most resveratrol. Mm-hmm. Now, your point is an interesting one, is if you're a human whose your ancestors come from the Arctic shelf, and you eat food designed, food from somebody who's been living in the, you know, equator for the last 20,000 years, you know, is that going to have a negative or a positive effect? That's a really good question. That's one I haven't thought of. My suspicion is probably not, because one of the things we think, if these, if just to, you know, this is out there. If the reason that we rely to a degree on polyphenols or phenolic compounds from plants is the same reason that we rely on exercise, is that the system requires a degree of stress to function, to explore that better phase space, then actually it may be beneficial. Because and this goes back to our other favorite subject at the moment, you're probably aware we're looking into space at the moment, space health. And one of the things that's been suggested is, well, plants go into space and they get stressed in space.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've suggested, and others have suggested, that one of the things you need to do is actually you need to eat stress fruit. And the best way of eating the stress fruit is to have the fruit, if you're living in a stressful environment, is have the same food you eat in that same environment.
Yeah.
The problem we got with modern production is that we've biased it towards mass, improving biomass, which means taking away all the stressors.
Yeah.
The way you get a big fat tomato is to take away all pathogens, all the stressors, give it plenty of water, and it doesn't contain as many polyphenols because it's not been stressed. So the argument is actually, you know, eating wild foods, which have been exposed to the natural stressors most of the time, is probably better for you in terms of what they contain, because the stress signal they give you is stronger. And so astronauts should be eating food which has been stressed on the space station.
What's interesting to me is that when you are in an environment where that these type of foods don't grow, is that you're exposed to, you know, much colder temperatures, which my understanding is that that promotes uncoupling, which is another way of dissipating. It's sort of achieving perhaps the same thing. And, you know, maybe if you're eating, you know, these really polyphenol-rich foods in an area where your mitochondria are all already engaged in quite a bit of dissipation, because perhaps you have a more uncoupled haplotype, because, you know, your maternal heritage is from this area, that you may dissipate too much. So it's not I suspect that plant compounds can be doing either. They can either be positive or negative depending on the context of the situation.
And that's a really good point, because one of the things we suggested in one of our papers is that the way that, for instance, cannabidiol works is by modulating dissipation. And if you think about it from that perspective, it tells you something straight away. And not everybody would like to hear this, but it says that at a very high concentration, you're going to dissipate to death.
Yeah.
Because I suspect that these things, it's not just classic, those, you know, I don't know if people know but what uncoupling is. The classical uncoupling is where you allow protons to flow back through the membrane in the mitochondria. And there are quite specific what we call uncoupling proteins. And there are the whole ANT proteins, the anion transport proteins, which do the same thing. There's also what we call futile cycling going on. But the classic uncoupler is this thing called dinitrophenol. Now, in the 50s, it was recommended as a weight loss drug. And what it does is effectively, it, makes holes in the, well, not quite, doesn't make holes, but it enables protons to flow back through the membrane of the mitochondria, uncoupling it. So the whole system has to work a great deal harder and it heats up. And that's exactly what, you know, you're talking about. When you get in a cold environment, that's what you do. Now, we know that cold environments, to a certain degree, will extend lifespan of small animals. Too much and they kill them.
Yeah.
Point about your making is clear. What we suggested is that these uncoupling compounds in the plant, what they do is transfer a stress signal, probably through a whole number of mechanisms. Nobody's tested what we suggested yet, because I think they're working on mitochondria within the plants. And don't forget, plants are full of mitochondria. This is what people tend to forget. They're just as important in plants as they are in us.
Yeah.
But the other thing is how are they anti-cancer and how are they antibacterial? Now, this is a really interesting question. The antiviral, they could have direct effects, and there's some, you know, they might stop binding or something. But certainly, the uncoupling aspect to this, and this is why I think it's really important, will induce cell death. In a eukaryotic cell, if you over uncouple, you trigger ROS, you trigger calcium, and you activate the innate apoptotic pathway. Good mechanism. That is a powerful antiviral mechanism. That's what happens in when you get flu. The reason you feel so ill is that all your cells are killing themselves to get rid of the virus. But direct effects on bacteria, we know they have their bacteriostatic, but they're also, they can actually kill bacteria and they can lyse them. And my suspicion is that they're uncoupling them so much that they kill the bug. So the same process in a bacterium, all these compounds are doing, is working in us. In us, it's a stress signal which goes, oh, right, I'm going to up my game. Now, the key here, and this is comes back to something you mentioned earlier on about inflammation, is what is inflammation? If it goes too far, it comes chronic, and then you get a self-fulfilling cycle. You have ROS production, that triggers more inflammatory pathways, and the whole thing just keeps going round and round and round and round and round, and it just gets worse and worse and worse. What we know is if you exercise, it's an inflammatory stimulus, but very quickly becomes anti-inflammatory. And one of the best ways of controlling inflammation throughout the body is exercise. As long as don't run 5 marathons a day, but if you run, you know, exercise a couple of times a week, you become more anti-inflammatory. And this is clearly associated with upregulation of antioxidant pathways. So that's a negative feedback mechanism. So when you look at things like ibuprofen, on the one hand, and I'm going to be controversial here, you could say, yes, it binds to COX-1 or 2 or COX-2, the CR20 oxidase. But we know it also binds to a great deal of many other things. Don't forget, nonsteroidals are probably derived from plant compounds originally, or some plant compound. What they're actually doing is doing mild uncoupling. And that then switches off the positive feedback system and then reduces the reactive oxygen signal, thereby stopping the vicious cycle.
Yep.
And I know from personal experience, I've had a few operations I've got. You know, I did a lot of martial arts when I was younger. I got dodgy knees, a dodgy shoulder. What I know, I only need to take one ibuprofen after exercise, about 2 hours afterwards, I get 3 days of relief. That is not direct painkilling. That is anti-inflammatory. It's a very low dose, and diclofenac's even better. I can't get it on the NHS anymore. But the point about that is that suggests a completely different mode of action to what people think is going on. You've got to remember, these compounds are based on, you know, the aspirin. You know, what's aspirin? Salicylic acid. What is salicylic acid? It's one of the most important plant hormones, stress hormones. It's actually very powerful, and I wonder if it's too powerful sometimes.
Yeah.
Of course, it raises this whole interesting question about how are these compounds actually working in us on a day-to-day basis. People take them for the painkilling, but actually I think by far the most powerful thing is the anti-inflammatory. Now, of course, anti-inflammatory is anti-pain, because it's all the same pathway. But it tells us that we're with these low-dose compounds, it won't work for everybody. It will depend on your circumstances, you know, your fitness, all sorts of things. But I suspect it's having a much more subtle effect by activating an anti-inflammatory system, not directly affecting. Because this is the issue with antioxidants. You know, you hear people take antioxidants. Most of them are oxidants as well.
Yeah.
Vitamin C can be an oxidant or antioxidant, depending on where it is.
The ascorbyl radical.
So your question is a really good one. You know, what happens when you go from one place to another? But my suspicion is, and we said this before, is that the cold adapted humans seem to be slightly more robust.
Yeah,
I think it's because we've had to deal with the ice shelf and cold and things like that. And you know, and if you look at hot countries, we looked into the Gulf, and we actually mentioned that we wondered if there was a thing called the Gulf metabolic syndrome many years ago, because in the Gulf, of course, you've got hot adapted populations suddenly being exposed to a Western diet. I just wonder, and I don't know if there's, I mean, Doug might support us on this. There's some evidence of mitochondrial haplotypes, which means you're just not as robust to shifts in that, because you never had to be. So in Saudi Arabia and things, they've got terrible problems with, you know, with metabolic syndrome and things, you know, because they're just living a comfortable lifestyle now, you know, and it's not what they were used to.
Yeah. I've heard that in that part of the world, they have quite a bit of trouble uncoupling. Their mitochondrial haplotypes are not very efficient at it at all, which kind of makes sense given where they are. But, you know, with modern environments, it's just completely maladaptive.
Well, yeah. I mean, the interesting thing about heat, though, is, of course, we know but they are adapted to very hot environments.
Yes.
And so they're dissipating in a different way because they still have but they probably have a different system for doing that. You know, they survive well in hot conditions, which we wouldn't survive in, or we wouldn't do very well at all in.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about biophotons. It seems like reactive oxygen species may be perhaps the main emission source of these biophotons. Yeah. Are there other ones?
good question. I was actually, Michael Sifra gave a talk yesterday, which he was talking about this yesterday. It depends what you mean. I'm still puzzling over this. For me, the most obvious choice is redox shifting, where you get changes in redox, where you get excited states.
Yeah.
I think that is the predominant source.
Right.
We're still not entirely sure. I mean, Michael Sifra is the guy to talk to on that one. You know, look at his papers. And then there's a Popsil. It's given a very good review on that one. And certainly the wavelengths seem to be largely explained from the oxidation or redox changes.
Yeah.
Are you thinking what you're thinking here as other sources?
Well, I wasn't sure if we should think about biophotons from, you know, are they arising directly as a result of metabolism, or are there other ways the cells are emitting light that it may be independent of, you know, energy flux? Because I think it's quite interesting to think about using biophoton imaging as a sort of diagnostic tool.
Yeah.
Because if it's basically a real-time monitoring of metabolism, if it's based predominantly off the reactive oxygen species.
I think it's what I understand, and certainly the work we've said. And I mean, the first thing to point out is, as an imaging system, a real-time imaging system, it's very limited.
Oh, yes.
The number of photons you're producing are measured in the hundreds to thousands per second per centimeter squared.
Or less than that.
Yeah. Very few. This is where theory comes in. If, you know, life is all about movement of electrons and it's not a perfect system. Well, actually, it may be a perfect system because, yes, you get to generate. I mean, this is the problem with reactive oxygen species. Everybody goes, oh, they're highly dangerous, you know, free radicals. Oh, no, they are part of the homeostatic system.
Yeah.
Produce them, and when they're produced, they feed back. So feedback. Without them, the system wouldn't function. It wouldn't work at all. So you have to have them. So mitochondria, this amazes people. Mitochondria can actually hoover up hydrogen peroxide. They're incredibly good sinks of free radicals. So, this is what I always say to biology. Well, biology's been doing this for 4 billion years. It's very good at it.
Yeah.
It works, you know. And so for us to come along in 100 years and say, oh, free radicals, oh, they're all damaging, you should get rid of them all. No, you kind of missed the point, really. But the metabolism is probably quite deliberate. Well, not to use the word deliberately, it's putting something behind it. It's not. It has evolved in a way as a feedback mechanism because that's the one that works. And within that, clearly you're going to have these triplet states and things which happen all the time within the chemistry, what they call chemi-like luminescence, which is quite natural. So the physics backs this up. As to whether there is another non-bioenergetic mechanism, I wouldn't have thought so. I don't know. I mean, I keep it open because I don't know. But it seems to me the most logical is just to follow the electron. What happens to the electron when it gets to a triplet state? Does it then emit photons? And we know this process happens. There's then obviously bioluminescence, crude light luminescence, which is a completely different mechanism. You know, that's ATP, that's luciferase and fireflies and things, and that's more of a magnitude brighter. But that's a direct, that's using ATP. So it's, you know, but the I think what you're suggesting, I think, is true. I think there is a potential diagnostic system here. And what we know is that as you get older, you tend to, if I mean, classic example of this is which Michael Siffler has done, but and there's quite a few papers on this. If you image somebody's hand, you need to do it for about half an hour. You can pick out the image. You get an image of the hand. It's, you know, produced by their own photons. If you put on hydrogen peroxide, you get a lot more photons coming out. But it seems as you get older, the hands get brighter. Now, this, I think, is a really interesting system, I think, if I'm right on this, suggesting that as you get older, you're under more oxidative stress. The definition of oxidative stress, of course, is that the system isn't quite managed its oxidation process quite as efficiently. To me, this is the biggest indicator of the aging process, because, of course, as you get older, you get brighter and brighter, which indicates the system is slowly decaying. It's like your the electrical circuit in the house slowly developing more and more leaks and earths, you know, as it gets older, because it just slowly degrades.
Well, I wanted to ask you, this is actually how I found you. I started to think about biophotons as a potential way that the body was dissipating energy. Because, you know, photons are, you know, they're quantized, so you can dissipate an exact amount depending on the wavelength that you dissipate. And I thought that seems like quite an interesting, really fine-tuned system to dissipate the perfect amount of energy that you might need to dissipate. And that's, I actually was Googling these terms, and that's how I found your paper initially a couple of years ago. And I was wondering, does that seem logical to you that biophotons are part of this dissipative system?
Well, I think back to what I was saying before, any dissipative system is going to have an inherently built-in feedback mechanism. And the question we've asked is, of course, so the cell produces biophotons. Yeah, so what? But as you say, is this a measured, quantized system, which is part of a feedback system? So what biology has done is incorporated, you know, much the same way as it's incorporated free radicals as a feedback system, as to maintain homeostasis. Are biophotons doing the same thing? So when you we sort of mentioned this in one of our papers, but is the theory here that production of photons in the cell is actually part of a feedback mechanism? So it is quantized because there are other molecules in the cell which absorb light.
Yeah.
And this we do not know. It's incredibly difficult to prove. We know the cell's sensitive to light of multiple frequencies, and going from the ultraviolet all the way into the infrared. The million-dollar question, I think this is one we're really trying to answer now, are those photons quantized and part of a feedback mechanism to maintain homeostasis? My suspicion is they might be. If our experiment we did with mitochondria is correct, you know, it shows that, you know, mitochondria can speak to each other using photons. If that is correct and is going on all the time, then it could well be. And the oxidative stress is an interesting one because of how, you know, this is back to an inbuilt hormetic mechanism. What it does is you get mild stress, you activate another pathway in the cell. And the thing is, you see, because it's quantized, you know, we think, oh, it's very intense light. But, you know, how many NADH molecules are there in a mitochondria?
Yeah.
And how many photons do you have to each of them have to absorb to get a state change? You know, there will be a threshold. They can absorb some, nothing will happen. But over a certain level, you will change the chemistry in that mitochondria. That will be part of a feedback mechanism. Is that real and on everyday metabolism? Who knows? It could be. We just don't know. But
it's such an interesting idea, given how full we are of these molecules that interact with light, particularly UV light, which I think is perhaps a remnant of a pre-oxygenated atmosphere where there wasn't ozone, and, you know, there were with UVC.
Yeah, there was a lot more UV that around. But it's interesting that, you know, what's one of the prime molecules in the cell that absorbs UV?
DNA.
Yeah. Now, we know that bacteria use DNA as a sunscreen.
Yeah.
You know, because bacterial colonies, if they get exposed to UV light, the top cells will commit suicide and release all their DNA, and that protects the cells underneath. And so that immediately goes, okay, so why did DNA evolve?
Well, that was one of my questions I wanted to ask you, is why is, if UV light is so damaging to the cell, as we are told, why is DNA absorbing UV light to such a degree?
Well, it always has. And you could argue that that's part of how its chemistry came about. But of course, it depends when DNA evolved, you know, what it did, you know. And it could be that the molecules that absorb UV light were created because they absorb UV light, you know. Yeah. And so, because we know the chemistry of UVs, you know, these, because any cycling of these molecules, I mean, DNA absorbs light wavelengths down as 240 nanometers, so well into the UV, in UVA, and so it's right down. And most of them, light shorter than wavelengths, about 260 nanometers, doesn't get through the atmosphere now. Mm-hmm. Probably more of it in the early days. But you see, would that be an issue if life had evolved in a thermal vent? No, it didn't matter. Mm.
Yeah,
as it evolved, it had to adapt as it went up, and this is what certainly plants did. I mean, so it's a very good question, but I think it's a bit of a chicken and egg. You know, well, these things absorb light at that frequency. Surely that's a problem, or was it the structure that ended up being DNA simply is the best structure for storing information, and it so happens that it requires these double bonds and these cyclic structures to do it.
Right.
Oh, by the way, they also absorb light in the UV.
Yeah, okay.
But that's the same. It's the same point I make about the electron transport chain. All of the chromophores are cytochromes. They absorb light.
Yeah.
Now, did that play a role in how this the electron transport chain evolved itself? It was the light energy that enabled it to evolve.
Mm.
And organized in certain structure. You see, it's quite often a chicken and egg here.
Yeah. I know you had you've had John Joe McFadden speak with the Guy Foundation, and I found his book talking about sort of quantum evolution quite interesting. Mm. He references particularly two papers, one by John Cairns and one by Barry Hall, where they seem to insinuate that cells are capable of sort of selecting mutations that would be beneficial to them in a specific environment beyond random chance. It seems like they're almost able to retroactively through time sort of select mutations.
Well, this goes back to the rather interesting... Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting theory. I mean...
Yeah, I don't know if it's been repeated. The one in 1988 by John Cairns with yeast, it was able to mutate to generate lactase much more above what would be expected by random mutation, almost as if it got to choose what mutations it got to get.
Well, this is a fundamental property of quantum theory, isn't it? I mean, it's how can we put it? So there's one idea that if you look at the proteins, you know, proteins, anything with more than three or four amino acids in it, I mean, it's peptide, but you hundreds of, they have to fold into the right shape. And when you stop and think about that for 5 seconds, you go, bloody hell, how the hell does it do it? Well,
yeah,
it's got this idea that, you know, these proteins, that there is this idea that they were selected for because there was only one state that worked. And this is idea that, you know, this is where quantum computers come in, because you can explore, you know, when you have qubits, you explore multiple eigenstates or infinite number of eigenstates, and only the one that works appears. You know, this is kind of really messes with your mind kind of thing. And I guess the John Joe's idea is this may be going on. And the answer is I don't know, but it doesn't seem entirely implausible, you know, because this goes back to the roots of hormesis. And, you know, and the idea, because one of the things when they were looking at radiation, there was a theory at the time that mutation and evolution happened because it was radiation which was inducing mutation. Of course, we now know that life naturally mutates because that enables it to adapt. There's built-in error in the system which enables it to mutate. Now, is that process far more subtle and a bit more quantum than we realize? You know, it looks for those states. And if you think about it from the quantum perspective, of course, it explores all those states. And the only state that is the one that survives, which is the one that dissipates.
Yeah.
That's the way of looking at it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting if you, I mean, I'm afraid I can't really go into too much detail on this because I simply don't understand it. But of course, if you remember, thermodynamics came out of understanding how steam engines worked.
Yes.
But then people then started to get the black, you know, UV catastrophe and everything, and they were trying to, that's where quantum mechanics came from the thermodynamics, and now it's going full circle. People are now using quantum mechanics to explore thermodynamics. And it's this, all this random movement of energy, but is it as random as we think it is? It's absolutely fascinating. And so there's a whole field of science there which is very maths driven, which I think may in the end answer the question that you just posed about, you know, the idea of quantum selection. But the point about it is that biology seems to have found the sweet spot where there's just the right amount of mutation to survive in the conditions that it evolved in.
Yeah.
So which way around was it? Because this then has very big implications. And of course, I'm interested in this, of course, in astrobiology, because, you know, there's some people thinking that, you know, there's no life elsewhere or it's everywhere. And I suspect if what we're finding here in our little solar system, I suspect it's everywhere. We might not recognize it, but I think it's everywhere. Whether it gets advanced or not is a different matter. But I think if dissipation is a natural state, what we would call biological dissipation is a natural state of the universe to accelerate the heat death of the universe, then yes, it's going to be everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big picture thinking, but, you know, and then does the quantum world come into this to enable the selection of those particular systems that survive and work to enable dissipation? So mm-hmm. It gets to a very deep level in quantum mechanics and theory, you know, random theory, et cetera. It blows your mind when you start thinking about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite difficult to conceptualize this, but another thing is sort of proving that these quantum events are happening. I know there's, you know, quite good theory behind the idea that complex one is an electron tunnel. Basically, you have all these reaction cores that, you know, you look at them and they're like almost the perfect length away from one another to be tunneling electrons. Mm-hmm. But how do you even go about proving that? That electron tunneling is happening in complex one.
Well, so there's a group that thinks they've shown it. I can't exactly remember how they did it. They think they have shown tunneling. I can't remember the chap I met in Rawson, I think, is the group up in Nottingham. Yeah, looked at it. But it's also saying that they reckon that they're actually chiral too, that they actually spin in one direction.
Right. Yeah. Well, it looks like that when you look at the.
It's a good question. I mean, this is the fundamental problem in quantum biology.
Yeah.
Is how do you show it?
Yeah.
There's some evidence you can see it in, say, the photon collection system in plants, but what actually is happening deep inside, the complex one, which is an immensely complex, because it's multiple subunits.
Yeah.
But I mean, I suppose the things like you can alter the electric field, does that prove it's quantum? Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah.
Isotope analysis. What if you put heavy isotopes in there? We know that isotopes cause all sorts of problems. But again, it's a bit of a nuclear bomb to crack a nut, because everything's going to be affected. You know.
Yes.
This is the problem with quantum biology. Is it's very difficult to prove what we're actually looking at is quantum. You know, is it just could it just be classically explained? But having a method to measure it is really, really tricky.
Especially, I mean, if you're trying to measure it outside the system that it's from as well, you know, you don't know what the effects of the whole system might be contributing when you isolate it.
Yeah, well, they've isolated it and they've shown that some of these molecules do appear to show, you know, they've attached them to semiconductors and things and shown it clearly there is tunneling going on.
Right.
You know, physics world going, yeah, and there's a protein that appears to be doing it. But the question is, you know, is it just, attaching a rocket engine to a mini and saying, well, actually it goes breaks the speed of sound, but that's not quite telling you what a mini is.
That's a good analogy.
So, you know, it's not an aircraft, but it's got an engine on it. You know, it's got a rocket on it. You know, that's the million-dollar question. But, I mean, are people trying to develop techniques to look at it? I mean, again, this is where the interesting thing with theory comes into it, because, of course, medicine is largely empirical in the sense that, you know, if it works, well, we use it.
Yeah.
Don't have to know how it works, but we use it. But now we're getting to the stage in medicine, I think, where the easy wins have been made. And do we need to take the next step up? And is this the next step? You know, well, actually, we need to understand the quantum underground, as was it Hameroff, one of the ones that described it, about in biology.
Mm-hmm.
Understand how it really works. Because clearly, you know, medicine's got to a point where we're not making great strides anymore.
Yeah.
You know, low-hanging fruit's being found. Making small progress, but it's not you know, this, you know, we still don't understand what aging is.
Yeah.
And sorry, you're not going to make a step change in medicine until you can extend lifespan. I mean, absolute lifespan. You know,
yeah.
And then we are right now we understand how to do it. We haven't got there yet. Yeah. You know, we can improve health span. And that's pretty obvious how to do that. But that's not really, well, it is medicine, but it's, you know, you go back to the days of Socrates and people, and they said, well, the physicians then would have said, well, eat that food and go take some exercise.
Yeah.
Have a cold bath occasionally. And they were saying that 3,000 years ago. And it worked. It was medicine. It was good medicine. It worked very well for most people.
Yeah.
But, you know, you say that today and it's, oh, no, you know, there's. I don't want to get involved in that argument.
Yeah. I could talk to you all day, but I feel like I've taken up quite a bit of your time already. You know, you've got this series coming up with the Guy Foundation about water, which I'm really looking forward to. Beyond that, what are you looking at? You know, digging into in the coming year.
We've been thinking about ideas. We're wondering, we may get back into, because we're doing a lot of our own research now and having another look at either the Boer photons, the magnetic fields, and I think, well, we haven't decided what we're going to do next. But I mean, there's so many. It's like a smorgasbord. There's a lot we could do.
Yeah,
but we might focus a bit on our own research. But certainly, we're talking to NASA and people like that, the space health, and I think watch this space, because we're certainly, if this quantum biology approach to space health starts to bear fruit, this could be some very interesting stuff coming out of that. You know, it's what's fascinating. For instance, is, you know, I don't know if you read the space report.
I haven't, but I've been speaking.
Well,
to
you read it? Because, so I wrote most of it. So it's you know, I mean, I've got some help from Bethany, one of our things. We got lots of people involved too. We had lots of sort of guest writers as well. But what's fascinating is space as a way of looking at accelerated aging, and of course that then feeds back into basic medicine too, and what we need to be healthy. And there's this. You know, this exploration now of mitochondrial function in space, I think, is, you know, we might come back, we might revisit this actually, because the evidence now is that, you know, is it seems that astronauts are getting quite ill. Well, they're not terrible, but you've got to remember that most of the astronauts to go up, or cosmonauts or technauts, I think they're called, are very, very fit and young, most of them, very fit, very way above average. So what happens when you send up Joe Average, who, you know, lives off pizzas and doesn't take any exercise, you know, and they, you know, what's going to happen to them? But the evidence is that even these fit astronauts are developing mitochondrial dysfunction quite quickly. I mean, within a couple of days, if it's true. So quite clearly, that environment is causing all sorts of problems. And the big question is whether it's to do with the lack of gravity, whether it's to do with, you know, cosmic radiation or whatever. I mean, all of these things have an impact. And what's rather fascinating is what's the priority for space research? And, you know, the point we make in this document is that, and we're not the alone in making this. There's another document which people from NASA published too, making the same point, really, is actually, are we ready to go to Mars yet? And actually, there's some very deep questions there, because if we're anywhere right on this, humans or complex animals and probably complex plants as well are going to have real problems with zero gravity, too much radiation, a lack of a magnetic field when you go beyond the moon, along on the wrong light spectrum. And some of this could be explainable through quantum mechanics. And if this is true, then we've got to rethink a bit how we build spacecraft. So, and we're exploring this at the moment. And you know, it's a fascinating example of, you know, I'll leave you with this kind of thinking. You know, the we came at this in the past from obesity, this idea of mitochondrial dysfunction and a poor lifestyle, but it could be that space is even worse than a poor lifestyle. And it suggests that, you know, if the fact is the data is correct, when we haven't got a great deal of data, because don't forget most people have only been up for, I mean, there's a few been up for several months, but only a few, you know, 3 or 4 weeks. And even those are within the magnetic field of the Earth. Once we go beyond that out into the interplanetary space, not only you've got zero or very low magnetic fields, you're exposed to massive amounts of cosmic radiation. And this is a big issue. Plus, you've got no gravity.
Mm.
what is this telling us about fundamental biology when you take it well outside of what we call its adaptive flight envelope? Aircraft have flight envelope, we have flight envelopes. You can't fly, you can't swim, you can't live underwater. There's certain things you can and cannot do. You can adapt, unlike aircraft mostly, but only to so far. The suspicion is that once you take our life outside into space, it's so far out of what it's used to that it can't compensate. And so you end up, and we know that you're getting inflammation and all sorts of things. So we're quite interested in this, and what is the mitigation strategies for this? I was talking to somebody who's involved in designs of centrifuges. Every single science fiction film you see, they got a rotating spacecraft. Why haven't we built one yet? Mm. It's not technology, money.
Interesting.
This is the point we kind of make. We're talking to people is when you look at the cost of obesity, for instance, it's predicted in America alone by 2030 to be over $1.2 trillion a year. What's the global budget for space research? 150 billion or less. NASA's only 25 billion. What do they spend on health? 200 million or less.
Now
we're not really doing this properly yet. If we want to discover what's going on in space and in particular aging, we need to spend a great deal more money doing it, and we're just not doing it. Science is suffering quite badly at the moment, especially basic research. And I wonder about what are the priorities of humans at the moment. Is it making money, or is it actually understanding our own biology?
Well, I think that's why I'm so glad to see what's happening with the Guy Foundation now, because it seems like you're actually doing research that matters, and that's actually helping us move forward in our understanding of what life is and how that relates to health.
I can't give you a concrete answer, but it'll probably involve space. It'll probably involve magnetic fields. It'll probably involve light and anything else we can throw at it, in gravity at some point, doing experiments in space, I think, is a logical step.
Mm. That's so interesting. I'm really grateful for your time. I don't want to keep you any longer. I know you're probably a lot busier than me. But I really appreciate it. And this was such an interesting conversation. I've learned so much.
So thank you for chatting. I mean, it's nice to talk. So, let's hope it goes somewhere.
Thank you so much for listening to the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like to keep up with Alistair's and the Guy Foundation's work, I've left links to their YouTube channel and website below. I cannot stress enough how brilliant a resource their work is. I've also left all of my links in the episode notes, so please feel free to subscribe and engage, as there will be much more content like this to come. Again, if you'd like to support my work, please consider subscribing to my Substack. This is where I share most of my thoughts and insights that go well beyond the scope of the podcast. This support really helps me keep all of this going. So thanks again for listening, everyone. Take care.